So today is the last day of our Introduction to Apocrypha course. It is bittersweet. For those of you who started joining 6 weeks ago, feels like a long time. Actually, I think it was more than 6 weeks ago because we skipped a week. It's been really nice getting to know all of you, hearing from you over email, hearing your questions at the end of class. You by now know how to reach me, but I'll put it into the chat again. And let's get started. And I'm going to try to leave a little bit more time today for questions and discussions, and you can feel free to ask questions both on today's class and also anything that's come up in your mind over the past few weeks. You know, a lot of people, when they read the Tanakh, here's my Tanakh, my battered Tanakh, 25 years old. When they read the Tanakh, they often don't think about the percentage of the pages and pages and pages preserved in the Tanakh that are wisdom texts. We don't study these texts for the most part, but a massive, massive amount of canonized material in the Tanakh is wisdom literature. Mishlei, Iyov, Kohelet and other texts that are preserved in larger books, there's a massive amount of wisdom literature preserved in the Hebrew Bible. And it doesn't only come as a response to the Hellenistic period, but precedes the Hellenistic period. Although today I'm not going to be getting into the nitty-gritty of dating books like Iyov or Kohelet. We could talk about that a little bit in the Q&A, but that is not my concern for today. I want to really situate our conversation today in the late Second Temple period. By the late Second Temple period, the second century BCE specifically, Jews living in Greek-speaking lands, so mostly outside of Judea, let's say primarily in Egypt and elsewhere and in the Ptolemaic Hellenistic world, but also in other regions of the Greco-Roman world, these Jews are highly aware of what's going on in the intellectual sphere around them. They're aware of Platonism, skepticism, stoicism. And I'm not going to spend 30 minutes or 40 minutes here reviewing these various schools, except to say that the fourth century BCE Platonic pursuit of metaphysical knowledge comes under criticism by the Stoics, by the skeptics in the third century BCE. And the question really is wisdom attainable? Is wisdom something that humankind can attain? And it's an open debate, right? The Platonists say, well, yes, you could attain knowledge, but not through the material world. You have to understand that everything you see and you feel through the sensory world is actually only representative of the truth, right? We're all sort of experiencing the forms. Remember the metaphor of the cave. The very famous metaphor of the cave. Everything around us has allegorical truth, but doesn't itself inherently contain the truth. And the question of whether you can attain knowledge and how to attain knowledge becomes a very important Jewish question in the second century BCE. And the process of attaining wisdom becomes democratized by Stoics who borrow this the question of the Cynics, what is the nature of a virtuous man? And the Stoics ask, what is human nature in general? What is human nature? The Stoic implication that anyone can achieve wisdom levels the intellectual playing field. And the question that everybody soon begins to ask is, what is wisdom and how do I get some? And again, I'm not saying that all the wisdom literature in the Tanakh is post-Hellenistic, these are very hard to date. But when we look at wisdom texts that are preserved in the Apocrypha, we have to take into account this broader Hellenistic culture, this broader Hellenistic question, what is wisdom? And also, where is wisdom? And the place of wisdom is very, very important. So what we're going to do is actually start in the Tanakh. We're going to look at two texts, one from Mishlei, from Proverbs, and one from Iyov, from Job. And we're going to see that in these texts, there's an implication, just an implication, that wisdom, whatever it is personified in the Torah. It's not said explicitly, but it's implied. And that in later Jewish Hellenistic texts, we see this stated explicitly, but in varied forms, not always in the same way. And so in the biblical text, there's an implication. And the question is, what is motivating this implication? So I think that's enough for an introduction. And now I'm going to share the screen. But of course, if you have, let's see, if you have the source sheet, you know, I'd actually recommend you putting it aside, because like I always do with our class, I find interesting things and then I keep adding them to the source sheet. So this is a little bit of an expanded. I found another passage from Ben-Sira that I wanted to add. And so I just kept sort of expanding and adding. So follow along, because there's a little bit here that is not on the source sheet that's on the website. And if you want the updated source sheet, you can email me. So we begin with Mishlei, with Proverbs. And we're not going to do this at all word for word, but look briefly at how difficult this Hebrew is. It's very, very, very difficult poetic Hebrew. Does not wisdom call? Does not understanding raise her voice? So first of all, what you see right away is wisdom is personified in a woman. We're going to see that this is a very important concept, both in Jewish Hellenistic literature and Hellenistic literature in general. The notion of lady wisdom, of Sophia, is Sophia. Okay, try to mute yourselves, because there are a lot of people on this call. So that would be great. Thank you. Or you know what? I'm just going to do it because I'm going to save you all the trouble. Hold on one second. Participants. Okay, great. Thank you, everybody. All right. Now, let's go here. Okay, something is wrong with my formatting, and I'm sorry about that. I tried to fix it, but I couldn't. Okay, so wisdom, Lady Wisdom speaks. To you, O people, I call. My cry is to all that live. O simple ones, learn prudence, acquire intelligence, you who lack. And of course, the question is, what is the relationship between this Lady Wisdom and Torah? Is she Torah? Is she protecting Torah? What is the relationship here? And it's not made explicit. But look at some of these verses from the question of where is wisdom? Not what is wisdom, but where is wisdom? So towards the end of the chapter, and again, I have such formatting issues this week. I don't know why. This might remind you of a Midrashic tradition that comes later about the creation of the Torah before the universe, the Torah being a blueprint for the creation of the universe. This Midrashic idea probably derives and is a Midrashic commentary on Iyov. Look at what Lady Wisdom says in Mishlei. Mishlei. The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of long ago. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. Now again, is this Torah or is this Chokhmah? Well, in Proverbs, it's Chokhmah. But when we think about this notion of what was created before the universe, we think of it as Torah. So again, it's not made explicit here, but it's a later connection that is made in the rabbinic period. But here we just have what's created before the universe, Chokhmah, Lady Wisdom. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth, and on and on and on. When God established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. So very beautiful language, very beautiful poetry. But what is speaking right now is not necessarily Torah, but wisdom. The connection between Torah and wisdom has not yet been made explicit. But another passage preserved in the Tanakh seems to do something very similar. Again, the question is, where is wisdom? It's a question that Jews are asking, that Greeks are asking. And again, you know, where, however you date Iyov doesn't matter so much to me, because I'm not saying this is responding to, you know, Middle Platonists, but the question is a question that's sort of in the air in the Second Temple period. Where is wisdom, and how do you find her, and how do you let her, how do you live among her? How do you live in her midst? And so look at, this Hebrew, it's not so hard to understand. Verse 12, v'hachochma me'ayin timatze, and the wisdom, from whence is it found? Eze makom binan, where is knowledge? Where's the place of knowledge? Lo yada enosh erka. Humanity doesn't know, right? Lo timatze be'eretz hachaim, she cannot be found in the land of the living. Now let's look at the translation. okay, where's the place of understanding? Mortals do not know the way to it, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. Remember the imagery of Mishle that also says, before the land and before the oceans were created, wisdom was created very, very first. And now in Iyov, not to harmonize these texts, because they don't have to be perfectly in harmony, but there's a little bit, there's similar imagery, but a different angle. The deep says, wisdom is not in me. The sea says, it's not in me. It cannot be bought for gold. Silver cannot be weighed out as its price. And on and on. So then where is wisdom? It's hidden, right? This is actually sort of a skeptic idea. Again, 3rd century BC Hellenistic thinking. Maybe wisdom cannot be achieved. Maybe all you could hope for is probability, is the probability of a knowledge of a thing. Knowledge here is hidden from the eyes of all living, concealed from the birds of the air. Only God understands the way to it and knows its place. He looks to the end of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. So is knowledge equated explicitly with the Torah? No. But you could read these texts and infer homiletically that connection, but it's not made. It's not made explicitly. So I want to use these texts to create a foundation for our discussion today when it comes to texts that were written much later, maybe written in Hebrew, but preserved and circulated in Greek, that absolutely were influenced by Hellenistic thinking, but sometimes respond against Hellenistic thinking. And I want to bring your attention to Ben Sira. Okay, so by now you should have some familiarity with this work. But lately, since I've been teaching so much on Zoom, I've realized it's fun to show people pictures. Everybody likes show and tell. And so I want to show you these images. What am I going to start with? Let's start with this little fragment over here. Okay. Well, actually, you know, maybe you could access this source sheet online so I could stop sharing and tell you a little story. And then I'll share the images with you again. And the story takes place in 1896. Now, the story focuses on twin, identical Presbyterian Scottish sisters. And there's no typo in what I just said, because that is what they are. If you've read my book, you know the story very well. This is the story of Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlop Gibson. And I think you'll enjoy this story time, and you'll see how it gets us to Ben Sira. In the late 19th century, it was very in vogue for white Protestants to explore what was today would be offensively considered, but to explore the Orient, exotic lands where they might find ancient treasures and take them back to their homes and donate them to museums. Now, of course, there are all kinds of ethical implications about this today, but let's just stay in 1896. So Agnes Smith Lewis and Margaret Dunlop Gibson were both independently wealthy. They were sisters, they were twins, they were Scottish, they were multilingual, they were super cool. And also, most importantly for our story, they were widows. They both coincidentally, tragically lost their husbands at very young ages. And they also had a fortune inherited both from their father and from their spouses. So they did what any women of means and intellectual curiosity might do in 1896. They go exploring. And they go to Cairo. Now, they're very devout women, and they're very smart, and they've educated themselves in all kinds of historical disciplines and languages. And at this time, one big interest was, especially for Protestant explorers, was can we find ancient manuscripts that have never been published before that affirm our religious convictions, specifically our Christian religious convictions? And so what they want to do is they want to find ancient religious manuscripts. And they do. They're very successful. They're successful beyond their wildest dreams. And I'm not going to tell you about their relationship with St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai Desert, but it's an unbelievable story. Agnes Smith Lewis discovers the oldest codex ever to survive, the Codex Sinaiticus, 4th century document. Look it up. It's amazing. I'm going to tell you the story about how they discovered Ben Sira. So up until this time, Ben Sira was considered to be a Greek document written originally in Greek by a Hellenized Jew. Now, there's a lot at stake in this debate. most Protestant scholars of the Bible, right? They have their Apocrypha, so they have their Greek texts. Ben Sira survives in Greek. Great. Ben Sira does not derive from a Jewish wisdom tradition, like an authentically Judean Hebrew speaking tradition. Ben Sira derives from a corrupted Hellenized. People, please understand that I do not believe this. This is what I'm citing. This is how people thought about it in the late 19th century. Ben Sira derives from a corrupted, Hellenized, assimilated Jewish milieu that's profoundly, profoundly influenced by Platonic philosophy. Now, there is one detractor in this theory who says, no way, I do not believe any of you people. Ben Sira was originally written in Hebrew because there are Semiticisms. There are awkward phrases in the Greek that when you reverse translate them into the Hebrew, it seems that they're more elegant in the Hebrew. So I think there's a Hebrew original which stands behind Ben Sira. And I think Ben Sira derives from a biblical wisdom tradition. And I think Ben Sira was written by a pious Jew who might have been Hebrew speaking in Judea. And the person who says this is Solomon Schachter. Now, Solomon Schachter, I love the facial expressions I'm getting right now. Solomon Schachter has no evidence for this. None. He's just a Romanian Jew brought up in a very pietistic world who happens to now be a professor of rabbinics at Cambridge University, also multilingual, also brilliant, also, you know, can hold his own against the biblical scholars, mostly from Germany, the Protestant scholars in Germany who are putting forth these theories about Ben Sira. In any case, Agnes Smith Lewis and her twin sister, Margaret Dunlop Gibson, they don't know Solomon Schachter. They're hanging out in Cairo looking for cool stuff. Now they're moseying along in the marketplace and somebody approaches them. I'm being a little bit poetic with my account here. I don't know if, you know, exactly were they in the market? Were they in an abandoned warehouse? I don't know. So they're approached by an antiquities dealer in Cairo who says, I have a manuscript. It's a very, very ancient, not a manuscript. I have a fragment of an ancient Hebrew document. It's incomplete, but I'll sell it to you. Now, they're educated enough to know various languages. They know Syriac, which is an Aramaic dialect spoken by Christians in the first through four centuries. They know Aramaic, they know Hebrew, they know Greek. So they're very, very well educated women. They're not just running around spending money, you know, thinking like about their hairdos. They're very, very knowledgeable. This person shows them the fragment, and right away, it seems to them significant. Now, they don't know what this text is, but the fragment seems ancient and it seems significant. They buy it. And they're like, what should we do with this little Hebrew fragment? What should we do? Well, let's show it to this person that we've heard of who lives in our neighborhood at the University of Cambridge, who's a Jewish scholar of ancient texts, Solomon Schachter. And so they bring it to Schachter. And right away, because he's so brilliant, he recognizes that this text, the verso and the recto, the front and the back over here, this text is the Hebrew original of Ben Sira. And he writes them a letter that's very hard to decipher, but he's like flipping out. This is the Hebrew of Ecclesiasticus. Do you see that? You could see the underline. He's underlining and he's sort of like flipping out. And oh my gosh, the fragment represents the Hebrew of the original of the, you could see a little bit. Please do not speak yet about the matter. I will come to you tomorrow. I mean, he writes with great excitement, yours, S. Schachter. This is pretty cool stuff, right? Like many people think my life is boring and I do just a lot of boring stuff, but then you come across this and you're like, wow, okay, maybe Malka does some interesting things. Not that I'm actually working on this, but this is very, very cool, I think. So when they show him the manuscript, he writes an article about this. He wrote an article about his response to it. And in the article, he says, I almost passed out. I almost fell to the floor in shock. Because his mind is so encyclopedic, Schachter, that he knows Ben Sira like the back of his hand in Greek. And right away, he realizes this is Ben Sira in Hebrew. So much is at stake here. He's fighting against a wave of biblical theological anti-Semitism coming from this school of German Protestant thinking, like Wellhausen and Doom and whatever, all these major biblical scholars who are saying wisdom literature that is written by Jews in Greek cannot have derived from a Hebrew speaking tradition. Because all that smart stuff had to have come from the Greeks. And the Jews were not interested in the universal pursuit of wisdom. They were only interested in their Jewy things, the ritual, the particularism, the cult, right? That's not, you know, this is not Jewy. In any case, I mean, Ben Sira is quite, he absolutely emphasizes the temple and the priesthood, but that's for another discussion. So the point here, I wanted to give you a fun story, but also to suggest, again, what I've been saying for the past six classes, which is that there is extreme fluidity between the Greek wisdom tradition and the Hebrew wisdom tradition. And let's not make a binary, right, between what you find in Iov and you find in Mishle, right? And the text that we're going to discuss in a few minutes, if we have time, that we're circulating in Greek, because the questions that were asked were common. The common question is, what is wisdom? Where is wisdom? How do we find wisdom and live among wisdom? But Ben Sira is very aware of a biblical tradition and using that tradition. So in any case, basically, the discovery of this fragment leads Schachter to go on a secret mission in December of 1896. He doesn't tell anybody, and he goes to Cairo, and he has to track down the rest of this document, right? Like, where did this come from? How does it, like, where's the rest of it? And this is the story of the recovery. I don't say discovery, because Jews in Cairo didn't know about it, but the recovery. Oh, Fran R., I was just about to say that. The recovery of the 250,000 documents in the Cairo Geniza. And Schachter spends many weeks befriending the beetle, right? The shamish, the person who's sort of in charge of protecting the shul known as the Ben Ezra Synagogue in the Jewish area of Cairo, called Fustat. And finally, they allow him into this very little, it's literally a hole in the wall, an attic, but it's like a crawl space. And he goes in, and what he finds is documents that, you know, are actually, I would say confidently, far more significant historically than the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Because the Dead Sea Scrolls represents a tiny sectarian community of about 100 people that lived there for about 200 years. The Cairo Geniza has texts that date from the early, early medieval period, the 9th century, all the way up until the time of its discovery, almost. But for about 1,000 years, yes, Sacred Trash, P.S. also my book. But yes, Sacred Trash is a great book. In any case, so the discovery of Ben Sira is hugely significant for many reasons. But let's ground ourselves in the second century BCE. Ben Sira is a Hebrew text. It was translated into Greek and circulated in Greek, but its ideas come from biblical tradition. Okay, now, and Hellenistic tradition, in the sense that that's what I'm arguing for, that there isn't a binary between these traditions. Okay, let's go back to sharing our screen. All right, so we have this very enthusiastic little postcard, and you can go to bensira.org and you can look at many of the manuscripts. It's a very, very cool website. But let's go to Ben Sira 24. Because in this chapter, Lady Wisdom speaks. And the question is, how is Lady Wisdom here different from, you know, I could talk about the Cairo Geniza if we're interested more in the Q&A section and the Damascus document. Very, very, very important discussion to be had. Okay, so wisdom in Ben Sira is a little different than wisdom in older and biblical texts. Here, it's much more explicit. And I think that there's an anti-Hellenistic polemic a little bit. It's much more explicit that wisdom is subjugated to God, not equal to God, not transcendent, but subjugated to the will of God. There's a clear hierarchy. Wisdom praises herself and tells of her glory in the midst of her people, in the assembly of the Most High of God. She opens her mouth, and in the presence of his hosts, she tells of her glory. And this is what she says. I came forth from the mouth of the Most High and covered the earth like a mist. And so again, you have this sort of primordial pre-creation sort of existence of wisdom existing alone before anything else. I dwelt in the highest heavens. My throne was in a pillar of God. Alone, I compassed the vault of heaven and traversed the depths of the abyss. You can imagine wisdom flying through the air, through the atmosphere by herself. Now, remember how in other texts, she doesn't exist in the sea. She doesn't exist on land, but she also exists before those things are created. Over waves of the sea, over all of the earth, over every people and nation, I have held sway. But there is something in charge of me, and that is God, right? So wisdom doesn't just get to chill out all day like flying through the clouds. The creator of all things gave me a command, and my creator chose the place for my tent. And my creator said, make your dwelling in Jacob, and in Israel receive your inheritance. So wisdom has to listen to God in Ben Sira. Wisdom is subjugated to God. So whereas in Hellenistic thinking, wisdom is the life, you know, the pursuit of wisdom is life's goal. Here, yes, as a means to worship the one true God, not a means in itself, not an ends in itself. The creator of all things gave me a command, right? And so she's subjugated to God. And what is the command? Go settle in the tent of Jacob. Go live among the people of Israel. And this implies to me, wisdom is the Torah. So we're getting there. It's not explicit yet, but we're getting there. And then she has an almost erotic invitation to the reader. Come to me, you who desire me, and eat your fill of my fruits. And remember, she is personified as a woman, so there is eroticism here. This is not like me reading into it. It's pretty explicit. For the memory of me is sweeter than honey, and the possession of me sweeter than the honeycomb. Those who eat of me will hunger for more. Those who drink of me will thirst for more. I mean, this really is quite erotic. All this is the book of the covenant of the Most High God. All of this is the book, the law that Moses commanded us as an inheritance. And now we get to a much more explicit articulation of what is wisdom. Wisdom is the book. I want to point out, so this is Ben Sira 24, a very, very, very famous passage of Lady Wisdom, but I want to put this into conversation with a later text, the end of Ben Sira 42. God possesses wisdom, both in metaphor and outside of the metaphor, right? God controls Lady Wisdom. Lady Wisdom has to obey God, but also God encompasses wisdom. God searches out the abyss. So it's God who sort of is all encompassing to the point where he encompasses wisdom. For the Most High knows all that may be known. He sees from of old the things that are to come. He discloses what has been and what is to be, and he reveals the traces of hidden things. Sorry about this formatting. He has set in order the splendors of his wisdom. He is from all eternity, one and the same. Nothing can be added or taken away. And so the reason why I think it's important to read these in conversation, these passages in conversation with one another, is because it seems that even if Lady Wisdom is the Torah, the most perfect personification, not personification, but the most perfect embodiment of all knowledge really is God for Ben Sira. So I think Ben Sira subdues wisdom a little bit, subjugates wisdom a little bit. So wisdom as embodied in the Torah is great and admirable and dwells among the people of Israel. But it's really God who knows all things, who understands all innermost secrets. So I think wisdom is a little bit subdued. And then if you put that into conversation with Ben Sira's general attitude towards women, you get something much more complicated because, I didn't include it here, but earlier in chapter 42, if you go to chapter 42, I think it's verse 13, women come from wickedness, which contradicts the Sophia tradition of knowledge. So there's a lot of scholarship on Ben Sira's extremely negative attitude towards women. Now, is this negative attitude towards women, can it shed light on how he subjugates Lady Wisdom to God? I think so. I think that there is something there. Now, I want to go to another apocryphal work, a late Second Temple document known as the Wisdom of Solomon, of course, not written by Solomon himself. The Wisdom of Solomon, remember the term that I've used, especially in the first two classes, pseudepigraphic. Pseudepigraphic means a falsely attributed text. Pseudo, false, epigraphy, epigraphos, written by. So a text that's attributed to an older biblical figure, but isn't actually written by that figure. It's very, very common in late Second Temple literature to write a document and then attribute it to an older biblical figure. And so the Wisdom of Solomon, no scholar says was written by Solomon, but we can imagine it being recited by Solomon because that's what the author wants us to imagine. Okay. Now, what does wisdom say? The wisdom of Solomon creates a partnership between God and wisdom. But it's also in wisdom that we begin to see explicitly, and then there's one more text after this where it really, really comes to the fore, the connection between Torah, law, right? Nomos in Greek, and wisdom, Sophia. And remember at this time, we've discussed this, especially in our second class, what Judaism is being accused of, right? Lacking wisdom, being sort of lying outside of the Hellenistic tradition. And so these texts are arguing for the integrity of the Jewish wisdom tradition. As servants, or also over here, for your dominion was given you from the Lord, your sovereignty from the Most High. The speaker tells the foreign human kings, as servants of his kingdom, you did not rule rightly or keep the law. So there's a chastisement of foreign kings, or walk according to the purpose of God. Wisdom is radiant and unfading, and she is easily discerned by those who love her. She is found by those who seek her. Now remember the question, not just of what is wisdom, but where is wisdom? And I want to point out, especially verses 13 and 14. She hastens to make herself known to those who desire her. One who rises early to seek her will have no difficulty, for she'll be found sitting at the gate. Now, I don't know if this parallel is significant, but I think it's very interesting that in the wisdom of Solomon, Lady Wisdom is found sitting at the gate. Now go to Proverbs 8:33. Where Lady Wisdom is not merely sitting at the gate, but the gates are hers. Happy is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. Now, is this connection significant? So I think it might be the wisdom of Solomon, again, subduing Lady Wisdom a little bit. These gates are not hers. So it's a little bit like, here, let's go back to over here. She's not as transcendent as we find her to be in Mishle and Eov. She's sitting at the gate, not her gates. I think that's interesting. And I think maybe we could discuss that more in the conversation. I'm not sure. I'm starting to see some comments here. Again, I'm not sure what these comments are. But of course, you know, for the past 6 weeks, I've been arguing that Hellenized Jews are pious. So I'm not exactly sure what the question is there, because we've been saying over and over and over and over that Greek-speaking Jews are observing dietary law, circumcision, and the Sabbath. So that's like a major, major theme of this course. Okay. All right. So the beginning of wisdom is the most sincere desire for instruction, and concern for instruction is the love of wisdom. And the love of wisdom is the keeping of her laws. So wisdom is no longer this thing that exists outside of time and space from the primordial creation. Although I will tell you what wisdom is and how she came to be. I will hide no secrets from you. I will trace her course from the beginning of creation and make knowledge of her clear, and now will not pass by the truth. So, you know, I do see here a much more explicit connection between wisdom and the Torah, wisdom and observing God's laws. But there's also a little bit of a subjugation in wisdom that I see in the Greek Jewish literature, in Ben Sira and the Wisdom of Solomon. If you look at Baruch, another pseudepigraphic text from the second century BCE, and again, you're asking the question, where is wisdom? We finally come to an explicit argument that wisdom is the Torah. Who has found her place? Who has entered her storehouses? Where are the rulers of the nations and those who lorded it over the animals on the earth? Those things vanish, the material world vanishes, but Israel doesn't vanish because Israel has wisdom. How great is the house of God? How vast the territory that he possesses? It is great and has no bounds. It's high and immeasurable. Who has gone up into heaven and taken her? So again, we have this theme that she's sort of beyond, and yet at the same time, she lives and she places her residence among the people of Israel. But finally, 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 look at this. I mean, this is the most explicit statement that wisdom is the Torah that we find in Hellenistic literature, as far as I can see. She did live sort of in this transcendent, unphysical realm from the beginning of creation, but afterwards she appeared on earth and lived with humankind. And by the way, this notion of Sophia becomes very Christologized in the Christian period, but we could talk about that. later. She is the book of the commandments of God, the law that endures forever. All who hold her fast will live, and those who forsake her will die. Turn, O Jacob, and take her. Walk towards the shining of her light. Do not give your glory to another. And again, we have this sort of eroticized, like, male-female metaphor here. Don't give your glory to another. Don't give wisdom away. Don't give your advantages to an alien people. And on and on. So, you know, I think I'm actually not going to discuss 4 Maccabees. It's a fascinating Stoic document that talks about the pursuit of wisdom and how the true pursuit of wisdom can only take place within the observant realm of obedience, Jewish obedience to God. But I don't want to talk about 4 Maccabees because I want to focus on these 5 texts that explore the place of wisdom. But I think that there is a progressive subjugation of wisdom that places it under the realm of the most powerful entity of all, and that's, of course, God. And so wisdom becomes transformed into the Torah and a medium, a means rather than an end. So the point is not just to find the place of wisdom and to live with wisdom, but to live with wisdom in order to cultivate and nurture a relationship with God. And ironically, you see this not in the older Hebrew documents, you see it in the later Greek Jewish tradition. Now, I kept to my promise a little bit that I would speak not for 45 minutes, but for 38 minutes. Why is Malka not offering the papers and sources today? They're on the website. And if they're not, then we have to talk to Rabbi Kelman because that's not my domain, but I sent them off to be posted. When I shared, did you not see that? Can I get some nods? You didn't see anything? Oh, you, some people say no, some people say yes.
They are on the website.
And when I was sharing my screen right now, were you able to see that?
Yes.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Okay. So I wanted to make sure that we could have time for conversation, not just about these texts, which I think are really ignored. I think the wisdom tradition, it's hard. You know, some people might think it's boring. The Hebrew is very difficult. And so they don't get a lot of attention. Even I admittedly put it at the end of the course because I did not think it would be so catching as, you know, or as exciting as the Daniel stories or 1 and 2 Maccabees. But I think that this is a very, very foundational and central part of the world of ancient Jewish literature. And so now I would invite you for 5 or 10 minutes to ask any questions that you want on anything in the Apocrypha. And I'll just say again, Baruch is not on the website. I did say at the beginning of this class, I expanded the source sheet because that's fun for me. And I always find things after I send it off to Rabbi Kelman, I find things that I want to add to the source sheet. If you want a more updated source sheet, you can email me and I'll send it to you. But you could also find all of these documents in the public domain on bible.aremus.org. So access to these documents should not be very hard, but I'm happy to send you the expanded source sheet. Okay, so two people are raising their hands. So first of all, Yael Gott, and then we'll go to Ms. Reed. So please, Yael.
Thank you. This was a very exciting class. I have two questions. The primary one is, there are some kind of out there theories that there was a demiurge through which God created the world. And I'm putting together and wondering how you feel about, if we look at God as ratzon, as will, and then Torah or wisdom as the demiurge through which God creates the world, how do you feel about that? That's number one. And the number two is, you said the word for wisdom in Greek. And what was that? It was beginning with G-N?
It's usually Sophia, which is embodied as Lady Wisdom.
But there was another word.
Nomos.
Nomos.
Which is translated as law, but that's a problematic translation. Because then when you get to the New Testament and you hear Jesus saying, I've come not to abolish the law and the commandments, you might think that he's rejecting the law, right? But taking all the ethical values of Judaism, and that's been very problematically misunderstood. Jesus is talking about the Torah, the scriptures.
Yes, yes. So nomos, and that's not related, or is it related to nosos?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay, that's it. Thank you. Thank you. Very exciting.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. I mean, one thing I would say to your first question is that a huge part of this conversation, which we have not discussed, is the concept of logos. I don't want to get into it because that could be its own course. But logos could be, it has many possible translations. All of them don't quite get it to the one thing because it evolves and there's a lot of scholarship on how logos evolves. But you could imagine, so logos is, it could be like the word through which the universe or the physical realm is created, but I don't know that that really gets to the older understanding of the logos. That might be like the first century Christian understanding of the logos, because if you look at the prolegomenon of John, you'll see in the beginning was the word, and he, you know, the way that Jesus is personified as the physical manifestation of the logos is sort of a new idea. So logos is the ratzon, I think. Like when you're talking about the ratzon, I would, in the Greek parlance, I would say, well, maybe that's the logos, the word through which God enters into the realm of the physical. Okay, so thank you very much. And now we'll go to Ms. Reed.
I was just wondering, with the knowledge that Ben Sira was a Hebrew document and very much, like, how is it, because when they found that information, it already wasn't canonized? I just wonder how it didn't end up as part of the Hebrew Bible.
I think that those great questions have very boring answers. You know, Ben Sira is a late document. It circulated in the middle of the second century BCE, and very quickly, oh, did we not do the introduction to Ben Sira? Was that a different class? I'm teaching every day, nonstop. Do we not discuss the introduction to Ben Sira? Oh my gosh, it is so much fun. It wasn't really relevant to today's discussion of wisdom, but I encourage you to look up the introduction to Ben Sira. It is so fabulous because it's autobiographical. It's written, the introduction is written by the grandson of the original writer, who says, here's why I'm translating the text into Greek. I'm translating into Greek because Greek-speaking Jews in the diaspora need this text. They need the text that my grandfather wrote originally for Hebrew speakers in Judea, but the diaspora needs this text because the phrase is the lovers of learning, one word in Greek, need the text of my grandfather. And so, you know, even if it was originally written in Hebrew, it took off in Greek and it was circulated in Greek. So the boring answer to your question is it's late and it was being read in Greek. It would not have been canonized in the Hebrew Bible at that point in time. And basically the Torah and the Nevi'im were done by the second century BCE for the most part. Now the writings, the Ketuvim, had some more flexibility because we know even the rabbis are discussing what's in and what's out. There's a lot more fluidity with this last category, but it doesn't make it in. And on the other hand, I should say the rabbis cite Ben Sira, which is part of the reason why Schechter thinks that this had to have been written originally in Hebrew. The writer cited as the rabbi cited as authoritative in bits and pieces. And so this is one of those few texts that were primarily being circulated in Greek and yet were probably read by the rabbis and respected very highly by the rabbinic community, which makes it very intriguing and actually quite distinct. Yes, it was originally written in Hebrew, but that wasn't taken seriously in the 1890s. I'm responding to Lawrence's question. Schechter writes about this in a 1906 article. I think it's on my desktop. I could send it if you want. Yes, keep going if you have a question.
No, I just wanted to say that I'm so excited by this, and it was amazing to see the handwritten letter. And you can tell he's just effusive, like, oh my goodness, like that's just like nerd heaven for me. So thank you for showing us that. I was just thrilled.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really fun. I found a few other things. I think the article where he really describes, it's a very, very famous article, how he describes all his discovery of the Ben Sira fragment and the Chiragonese. I think it's a 1906 article. You could probably find it online, but yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Malka. So I'm impressed by the appearance of so much Shir HaShirim-like language when he's talking about Chachma.
Oh yeah, the eroticism?
Well, yeah. And so like he's combining pieces of Mishle where the Chachma is a woman, and then the Shir HaShirim version of, and you know, with the Midrashic overtone that it's not just a woman, but it's really, you know, God and the Torah and all that stuff. And he's pushing it all together in his version of Mishle / Shir HaShirim. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's a very good way to look at it, you know, especially this very powerful metaphor of the marriage metaphor between God and Israel that we see so prominently in biblical prophetic literature. has maybe kind of corollary in Hellenistic thinking of between Sophia and humankind. And so Ben-Sira is taking that, right, and like bringing into conversation with Sophia. So yeah, absolutely. I think, and I hadn't thought so much about Shira-Shirin, but I think it's absolutely true. Thank you. Again, I'm sorry that I can't read all of these comments in the chat. I have been hearing from all of you, you know, almost on a daily basis, which is fun. And I do apologize when it takes me a few minutes to get back to you. I can't read all of the chat right now. So definitely feel free to send questions over, or we could take one or two more right now. Anyone else? Well, this was a lot of fun.
Malka.
Yeah, please.
What is the relationship between the apocrypha and the pseudepigrapha with later Midrashic and Talmudic ideas?
Well, that's a massive, massive topic, and you need to take it text by text. So if you take, for example, the pseudepigraphic document Jubilees, which was written in Hebrew in the 2nd century BCE, 15 copies of this text are found at Qumran. It's sectarian, but very popular. You could find traditions in Jubilees that resurface in later Midrashic traditions, particularly the collection, the 5th century Land of Israel collection, Bereishit Rabbah. And so what does that mean? It means that there are Midrashic traditions circulating orally that are making it into ancient documents and later resurfacing in Midrashic documents. So for example, Jubilees talks about the 10 tests of Abraham, right? That shows up later in rabbinic literature. Josephus talks about the fiery furnace that Abraham survives. Again, that shows up in later Midrashic documents. So it's not, you know, I can't say anything about the collection of pseudepigrapha. That's a, like I've said at the beginning of this course, that's a artificial 18th century modern collection. The pseudepigrapha is not really a collection, right? It's just like everything that didn't make it into a canon. But what I can say is on a text by text basis, you can analyze certain Second Temple documents and think about them as reflective of oral traditions that later make it into later rabbinic texts. There are a few cases where I could even say there's a literary connection, meaning the rabbis have this older text and used it. But most of the time, it's not a linear connection. So Jubilees is a great example of a Second Temple text that is not canonized. It is canonized in the Ethiopic Christian tradition, but not canonized in the Jewish tradition. And suggests that many of the 5th century CE Midrashic traditions are actually very, very ancient. And what Jubilees does is it brings some of these traditions into a period that's 700 years earlier before the Midrash was written out. So that's pretty incredible. And I think, again, you take it on a text by text basis, and there's a lot of good scholarship on that question.
Can you recommend any of the scholarship?
You know, on Jubilees, so there are a few scholars who do very nice work in terms of putting Second Temple traditions into conversation with rabbinic literature. Obviously, Jim Kugel would be like the number one, you know, James Kugel. Isaiah Gaffney, Yeshayahu Gaffney would be another one. I would start with How to Read the Bible. I would start with Kugel. Yeah. Kugel and Gaffney would be my number two. And then, yeah, I mean, there are other scholars who do it, maybe not as prolifically.
Thank you very much for your whole course.
Oh, thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it.
And James Vanderkam on Jubilees. Okay. Yes, thank you for being here. Thank all of you for being with me on this journey. And I hope to see you all again virtually or in person one day soon, please God.
Yes, are you teaching anything again soon that we may be able to find you?
Thank you. I'm teaching a three-part series for Drisha in April and May on the rabbinic reception history of the 10 plagues. I'm around, you can find me. I teach for Hartman, I teach for all kinds of places, but I'd love to find a time to, you know, I can come to your communities virtually if you want to bring me in. I'd be very honored to talk to you.
Do you have a website where we can find where you're teaching?
Well, I have a website, malkasimkovich.com. I haven't updated it in 2.5-3 years. You can find me on the ctu.edu website. I teach at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago.
But do you put where you're teaching on your website so that we can find you easily?
Yep, my CV is on there. So you can, I'm not.
So put your calendar there too, so we can keep up with you.
thank you. It's very kind. That's very sweet. All right, I'm going to sign off, and that's it. Take care, everybody. And if you're celebrating, have a wonderful Chag Kasher V'Sameach. Take care.
Thank you so much.